the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is the voice of John Barber. The first voice you heard was that of Sarita singing Sunny, an absolutely gorgeous rendition of that song. The second voice you heard was that of the emperor of entertainment this last 80 or 90 years. That was Francis Sinatra, the night he took over The Tonight Show and booked me to do a stand-up, which you can find if you just go to YouTube and Google John Barber and The Tonight Show with Sinatra, you'll see it. It's a wonderful, wonderful show. I want to welcome you all to John Barber's World. It's October 31st, 5 p.m. here in Las Vegas, where Donald Trump is about to return and speak. Now, this is where a lot of people are hoping that what happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. A week from tomorrow will be the real Halloween, all tricks and no treats. Hillary, as you know, is up in arms again over the FBI digging again into her emails. The E in email, in her case, stands for evidence. And the FBI stands for finding bitches' indiscretions. Now, you know, Donald Trump may just surprise a lot of people. If he becomes president, first of all, he'll save a lot of money. He'll no longer have to buy politicians. Some folks, quite a few, I'm afraid, are concerned that if he becomes president, he'll be shot. But more and more are concerned that if Hillary becomes president, the rest of us will be shot. When one becomes president in this country, attitudes about their behavior change. While Trump is still just a contender, his supposed groping of women is touted as a horror. But when Bill Clinton was president, his serial raping of women was heralded as a hobby. Then last week, you probably saw, they had a porn star say she was offered $10,000 by Trump for a role in The Hay, which he turned down. If you believe that, you believe Bill when he said, "I never had sex with that woman." There is no way an unknown porn star is going to turn down the famous personage of Donald Trump, turn down three times the money she gets for balling unknown guys in public. There was a time in America when a big rig was known as a truck. Now it's an election. And because of that, I am not voting because I don't know if my vote would count or to whom it would go. If I were going to vote, though, I would write in Julian Assange. First off, every president since they murdered John Kennedy, with the exception possibly of Jimmy Carter, has lived in this country, and the country's become the worse for it. Assange would be assigned to stay in a foreign consulate, and instead of addressing Congress every January or whatever with a meaningless State of the Union, he could keep us all better informed about the truth, as he does now, by sending us all a personal email. Right now, though, to our Halloween treat, an unbelievably prolific writer and thinker, a PhD from Yale, the author of over a dozen immensely readable, informative books, including the two I put on my Facebook page, which I just finished reading, The Face of Imperialism and Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. Cornel West says, quote, "We need him now more than ever, a towering prophetic voice in American life unquote. Please welcome Michael Parenti. Michael, thank you so much for being here. It's an absolute delight to be talking to you.
Thank you, John.
Now, I asked you before we started the show if you were a native Californian. You mentioned you were living in Berkeley right now, that you came from New York, and that you had recently published an autobiography. So for the sake of letting people get to know who you are, where you came from, how you came to become a writer, tell us what the name of your autobiography is.
Yeah, well, it's not an autobiography. It's, you might call it a memoir. You know, it's about a theme in one's life. The name of the book is called Waiting for Yesterday, Pages from a Street Kid's Life. And that's what it's about. It's about growing up in Italian East Harlem, it was, or East, some call it East Harlem, some call it Italian Harlem. And it's a very poignant book, and people really like it and enjoy it and tell me about it and say they read it twice. It's the first time I've had someone, or it's been a while since I've heard someone say I've read your book twice, you know.
Well, I absolutely love books like that, even if they're from people or authors I've never heard about. It sounds to me like sort of an Italian-American version of Angela's Ashes. I love Frank Court's book, and I'm sure
That was about Ireland, wasn't it?
That's right. It was about Ireland. So tell us what it was like growing up.
This is about the family, the church, the school, the gangs in the street, the friendships. We had all sorts of things that happened, and a lot of it is humorous, and a lot of it is a bit sad. You know, not a lot, some of it. And
being Italian, you obviously were probably raised Catholic with a bunch of siblings. Were you?
Well, no, I was an only child, believe it or not, because my... I was the firstborn, and my mother had a physical condition. It was impossible for her to really have any more children. It was very dangerous that she had me, but, you know, that's when she found out that you shouldn't have done this. But I came through it, I survived, and so did she survive, and so did my father survive. And
she must have doted on you, being an Italian mother. There are more songs about mothers in Italian than there are any language in the world. So you must have been thoroughly spoiled as a kid.
Yeah, but she was an Italian-American woman. She was born in New York. She was the youngest in a large family, some of the older ones were born in Italy and brought across when the family came, but she was born in New York, and she was, you know, fairly Americanized, so it wasn't one of those Mamma Mia mothers.
What did your father do?
My father was a working man. He drove a taxi. He drove a bread truck. He worked as a bartender for quite a while. He did all sorts of work, just about a working stiff. Very intelligent man, but had no opportunity for education
you obviously inherited his genes. Michael, what is the most vivid memory you have as a child, let's say under 7 or 8 years of age?
Oh, I never sat down to figure that one out. I don't know. There was a lot of good memories I've had, and some pretty rough ones, you know.
How far did you get in school, and what was your first job?
I went all the way. I went right through high school, and then I stopped. I didn't go to college because my mother was dying at that point, and I had to... I had to bring money home, you know. I felt I had to do that, and we were kind of pretty low on the totem pole as far as income came. this was back in the days before anybody, any of us had heard of a health care or health insurance or anything. So I went to work, and I worked a couple of years, and then I ended up going to Europe. And, well, it's a story. I don't want to go into it.
But you ended up going to Yale and getting a PhD. When did you?
Yeah, I came back. I went to college, and I got my bachelor's degree from City University. Thank God that there was such good, such a, you know, that there was such free tuition still in those days. And then I won a stipend and a scholarship to Brown University for my master's degree. And then Yale invited me on to come on in and pay me a stipend to support me, and I got my doctorate at Yale, and then you know, went along and became a political scientist, wrote articles in the journals and the special publications and all those things, and then I started writing for a broader public, because I started developing interest in other subjects like racism and the war in Vietnam and all that, and that meant trying to take and apply my discipline to the basic big questions of the day. In fact, one of the struggles in political science was doing that. Are we going to keep writing these esoteric articles that only 25 people will read, or are we going to write things that are that will shake the minds and brains and hearts of larger audiences? And I've been doing
I'm so glad you've done it, because I've read a half a dozen of them on various subjects, and the two that I have in my hand, you mentioned earlier the business about health care. And in your Profit and Pathology and Other Indecencies, mm-hmm. is a story that I think is really important for you to tell, because I know so many people today, and my cohort on this show certainly falls into that category. He is having some health issues, but you have, I guess it's called... it's chapter 5, and it's called Free Market Medicine, A Personal Account. Could you tell us a little bit about that? It must have been eye-opening for you.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the chapter that consists of about my dealings with medicine. And then
exactly.
Chapter 6, I like Chapter 6 even more, because I got a whole bunch of other people all giving excerpts from their experiences, and which was induced by that chapter was an article. And then suddenly I got this flood of things back from people from all over, different countries, different place in different parts of the U.S. and talking about how you know, how terribly treated they were, how things didn't go right, and it's really a kind of a dangerous thing, the health system. And, I would advise people not to be too eager about going into hospitals. The iatrogenic death level is really pretty high.
It's 80,000 a year. Deaths in hospitals.
8,000?
80,000.
Yeah, I was going to say 8,000 is way too small, John.
Yeah, no, it is 80,000.
80,000, yeah. That's
and in your article, what was it that took you to the hospital in the first place, and what was it that began to upset you while you were trying to find a cure for your ailments?
I had a hernia. and a bad sneeze and a bad cold. No, I had a hernia, and because I was lifting something just way too heavy, and that meant I had to get a mesh put in, and and that's when I was discovering all sorts of things about hospital rituals. You know, you get a contract there just before you get rolled out, and it says things like, you will not take any measures against any working member of this field should they extract an organ or or this from your body. Jeez. I said, wait a minute, extract an organ. I mean, I'm really attached to some of my organs. You know?
Now, you published that as an article, and I'm sure you said you heard from people overseas, but people overseas don't have to go through the horrors of medicine that people have to go through in this country. A friend of mine in Phoenix 3 months ago had to have a colonoscopy, which is a very, very simple procedure. And she called her insurance company, I forget the name of the company, and they said that they would cover it. She had the colonoscopy, and they charged her $10,000, and she had to pay $1,023. That is a sin, Michael.
Yeah. It's really bad. The situation is really terrible. Yeah, with Obamacare or no Obamacare, there's so much that's just still, you know, so wrong. I've just had my Social Security cut because I came to Plan B. Oh, I don't even want to go into it. Let's not torture ourselves and our poor listeners. You know, your phone is going to be ringing. Listeners will start telling you their stories. You could have another whole program on that.
How can they possibly cut a senior citizen Social Security? How can they do that?
Because if you have not used Plan B, oh, I don't remember how it goes, which was to pharmaceutical stuff, and I didn't, and I saved a lot of money, and I never use it because I don't do the medications that they hand out. Usually I do alternative stuff.
That's
if and when I do need. But to get into a secondary medical insurance program, a bigger one, you know, to back up your Medicare, to do that, you have to take this plan. And so once I had to do that, this showed I hadn't been doing it, and I had to pay $700 back or something, and then I have to
pay every
month. I now pay $100 less comes out of my rather modest my Social Security. It's really a shock. You need a lawyer more than you need a doctor. You know.
You mentioned
I said that when I was sitting there on the
funny.
Table.
You mentioned earlier that you went to city school and the tuition was free. The remarkable change you must have seen, having been a political science professor and teacher and writer, the change that you've seen in our educational system. I guess if you start at the top with the dumbing down, but the worst thing in the world is student loans. And not one of the candidates, except Bernie, who turned out to be the Democrats' Ron Paul, he turned tail and ran. He was the only one who talked at all. And Elizabeth Warren at one time was talking about student loans. You never hear it anymore. And I understand if you die, you cannot discharge the student loan. You cannot discharge it in bankruptcy. Tell me about that.
You mean, no, I don't know about that. You mean someone has to, someone inherits that loan or something?
The family inherits the debt. If I am wrong, and I don't think I'm wrong, Joe Satilli, who will be on in about 10 or 15 minutes or so, will straighten me out about that. Now you have in the other book, which is really fascinating to me, is the one called The Face of Imperialism. I mean, America keeps denying that it's imperialistic when it obviously is. And Chapter 8 is called Target Cuba. Now you and I have lived through 50 or 60 years of Cuba somehow being a target, and in the CIA's early efforts to kill Castro, they probably backfired and ended up in the murder of John Kennedy in Dallas. Why that one whole chapter? Tell me about why the one whole chapter on Cuba and where we are today with Cuba.
Well, it draws the line so clearly as to how dedicated U.S. policy has been toward any country that tries to use an alternative system that will use the land, the labor, the natural resources of the country and the capital, and use it for the development of the needs of their own people. There's a lot of things about Cuba you can complain about, and you wish they, and in fact, they do complain about them. I was just there a few years ago, and especially the young people seem to, you know, say this, how we want that, how we want that. And I would say, yeah, I think that's a legitimate complaint, but you know, you got some pretty good things going here. You should be aware of it, not take it for granted. Did you have
difficulty getting to Cuba a few years ago?
No, it was okay. I think there was a special flight to go to Cuba, a special airline, a little one, and it took some doing to get down to Miami. I remember that night. I had a wonderful time. Yeah, it was quite nice. It was for a book festival. Cuba has every year a big book festival.
How wonderful!
Goes around to different parts around the country, and it starts in Havana, and there'll be thousands of people come browse the books, and a lot of them are just there for the sun and getting a slice of pizza and something like that. But there are a lot of people are looking at books and reading and thinking, and it was nice to be there, and you get these young, attractive interpreters who bring you around and show you this way and that way, which added pleasure to wisdom. So that was
do you recall the moment, Michael, years ago? I recall it with me because we're exactly the same age. But do you recall that moment years ago when you began to doubt U.S. policy and attitude towards Cuba?
Yes, I think. Well, you know, I started doubting Vietnam. I was first saying, well, we've got to make a stand there. We don't want them to be destroying communism, taking over and destroying people and that. And then I began to question the people who were pursuing a war in Vietnam, saying, is it really necessary? Is this what we have to be doing? These people were fighting off the Japanese occupiers. They fought off a British invasion. They fought the French for 20 years, and now they're fighting us. Why can't we leave them and let them find their own way? And then I began raising questions about the people who were pursuing and creating these policies and realizing there's a pattern, and other places went the same way. And then I began questioning the system that created these people, that created these policies. And I started asking just questions and getting red baited like crazy. I said, wow, it doesn't take much for people. I thought I was in the land of the free, and it's not that free. So,
well, you almost sound like Jim Garrison. When I interviewed him, it was September 5th, 1981. Interviewed him, put him on tape for 3 hours, which is the foundation of this unbelievable documentary coming out, which Garrison continues to tell the story. It's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. When I first did the interview with him, I was just interested in this case. But he talked at so much length about the media, the way that you understand it. And he said to me, when I said to him, why did you pursue it? Whatever made you think you could go up against the federal government? And he said, I guess I thought I was living in the land I was born in. And he said that in 1981. And that was, you know, 40 years ago, which is astounding. When did it happen then? You obviously, because I remember all those things, Better Red Than Dead. I mean, I hold dual citizenship. I'm also a citizen of Canada. When I was just a kid down there at the time, and I would bring up the great health system we had in Canada, I didn't never had experienced it. I just knew we had a sort of socialized medicine. It didn't cost you an arm and a leg, and you didn't have to sign a contract that you would sue if body parts were removed. And I had people hitting me. Physically hitting me, calling me a red for crying out loud. And I barely even knew what a red was when I was a kid.
Isn't that amazing?
Now,
yeah, it's amazing.
When it came to Cuba, when did you begin to, well, obviously if you had doubts a bit about Vietnam, but Cuba was before Vietnam. So when did you begin to have...
Actually, you're right. Before the Vietnam War, it was a general feeling of, you know, leave the Cubans alone. Let them try this. They've had a terrible dictatorship. I mean, I remember I was in college, Batista's dictatorship, and terrible stories I had heard about, you know, kids being tortured who protested and this and that. And now here's a new guy. He seems to have a lot to say, this Castro fellow and so forth. But it seemed to me like they were trying to do new things, like a literacy program was coming in and this and that. And I had a friend who came back from Cuba, and it was about not too long, maybe a couple of years after the Cuban Revolution. By that time, I was saying, leave them alone. Why do we have to... when the invasion, the
Bay of Pigs.
Bay of Pigs invasion. Thank you, John. By the time that came, I was already against that war. And I remember I was sitting in the car with some colleagues of mine. We had a carpool to get to work at State University. And coming home, I said, this is a mistake. This is a terrible thing. This armada that they're sending. It was going on right then.
Yes.
And the others were saying, we got to draw the line somewhere. We've got to draw the... It's only 90 miles away from our shore and this. And I said, oh, you're being frightened out of your brain here. I mean, this isn't the way to go and so forth. And Cuba can't really take over
That's
the U.S.
I did not have your political savvy. I didn't have any interest in politics. My interest was show business. You might remember, being from New York, the very best late night talk show host was Jack Parr. And after Fidel Castro took over Cuba, he was honored in New York. He was on the Jack Parr show. I remember he went into Harlem and he ate chicken with 10,000 blacks leaning out of the window, hollering Viva Fidel and all that kind of stuff. People loved him, okay? It's like Viva Zapata. Then all of a sudden, a week later, he's being called a commie. Yeah. And I wondered why. And so with no real interest, I began to research. And what it said, you know, they always say follow the money. Follow the money. So I started to read about the money. Well, when he took over, he said, in order to have a revolution, you have to have an economy. In order to run an economy, you need oil. So what he did is, oil at the time was like $1.20 a barrel in the United States and like 68 cents from the Russians. So he bought Russian oil. When it came into the refineries in Havana, the American companies owned those refineries and they would not refine the oil. So Castro said, I have a choice. And what he did is he nationalized this. Now, what he did is...
And then he got oil from the Russians. And then he sold them his cotton.
He repaid the oil companies. And guess how he determined the value of these properties? He found out what their income tax returns were to the United States government over the value of these properties, and he paid them that to the nickel. And to this day, you cannot find out these facts in any university in the United States, including your once heralded Yale University with their skull and bones. I hate to add that, but that's, you know.
Go ahead.
My whole life has been interested in show business, but now...
Well, you should know that Cole Porter went to Yale. Okay, just just letting you know. Just want to remind you.
Yes, he did, you know, and they've made two or three failed attempts at making the perfect movie about Cole Porter. As much as I loved Cary Grant, his version of Cole Porter.
Oh, that was terrible.
Oh, my God.
But then the more recent one, which I've seen twice now, what was the more recent one?
It's not bad because it's almost like a play. It's almost like a film play, and it's very theatrical. I'm glad you liked the second one because it was a whole lot better.
What was his name again, the lead, do you recall?
The actor?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't remember. Oh, God, he's so good, too.
Yeah, we know him, right? Yeah.
He was in Sophie's Choice. He's been in a number of movies with Robert De Niro. Well, I'll find out the name after you've gone. Anyway, listen, Michael, it was an absolute joy talking to you. The two books, folks, are called Prophet, Pathology, and Other Indecencies, a fabulous read. The other is called The Face of Imperialism. By Michael Parenti. Okay, Michael.
And if someone's interested in the memoir, that's called Waiting for Yesterday.
I love it, and I will get it. Do we go to Amazon to get it? How do we get it?
Yeah, you can go to Amazon. They've got it, yeah.
Okay, where can... Do you have a site that people can go to learn more about you and your work?
Yes, there's a www.michaelparenti.org, O-R-G. Michael Parenti is one word. Parenti is parent with an I at the end, and it's just one word, Michael Parenti.
It's a perfect name for you. Two last questions. Do you have children, and were you married?
Yeah, I was married, and I had a son, and my son is a political sociology, got a doctorate at the... He got a doctorate at in England. What was the name of it? London School of Economics.
Oh, my goodness. Is he an only child?
He's published about four books or five books.
What's his name?
His name is Christian Parenti, is his name.
And he an only child, too?
He's an only child right now, but he...
Wait a minute, you're planning on more at your age?
The world is so challenging, so dangerous, so struggling. I said, think twice before you go that direction. I mean, I really can't tell him what he wants to do. You know, he's 47 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
His wife is lovely.
Does he live here or does he live in England?
No. He lives here in the U.S. He was in England just for 2 years.
Okay. Well, Michael, again, I want to thank you so very, very much. And, folks, go to Amazon. Look at Michael's books. You'll just love them. They're a great, easy read.
And please do go to my website, michaelparenti.org. Yeah. And you'll find articles there, and you'll find books, what books to get and when to get them. And all that.
Okay. Well, okay. Michael, I'm going to say goodbye to you right now. I don't want you to leave the radio, though, because we have a wonderful, another Italian-American coming on, Joe Satilli.
It's our night.
It's right. I'm telling you, it is, and there is no one that I know who is as smart as Joe Satilli, is well-informed. He does put out the best newsletter in the country, and I'm going to make sure that he sends you a subscription because you will love it. So I'm going to say goodbye to you now, but don't go away. Come back, folks. We're going to be right back with Joe Satilli.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. A tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World. This is John Barber. It's 5 o'clock here in Las Vegas, and joining me now is one of my very, very favorite people, and as I said to Michael just a couple of minutes ago, the brightest journalist I know, and I would be lost if I were not being able to partner with him in doing this show, Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show. Now, during the break, people didn't hear it. They were listening to whatever they were listening to during the break. Hopefully it was George Knapp plugging The Last Word in the Assassination. But you mentioned Michael Parenti's book about the death of Julius Caesar. Tell us more about that. That was so interesting.
Yeah, it's The Assassination of Julius Caesar. I believe it came out in 2003. I think the subtitle was A People's History of Rome or of Ancient Rome. And my background, as our listeners may have gleaned or I may have said, and I try not to talk too much about it, but I have a graduate degree in history. My field of study was fascism. So I was familiar with Michael Parenti's work because of his position on the left among academic political scientists and historians, you know, Herbert Marcuse and that wing of history. But my undergrad degree was on ancient history. In particular, I studied a lot about Roman propaganda, which I found very, very interesting. And this book that came out in 2003, which I think in some ways he timed also in response to what was going on in the United States at the time. Remember, we were in the post-Patriot Act clampdown, and we were wondering if America was finally transitioning from a republic to an empire. And generally, historians mark the transition, the ultimate transition to empire, with the coming of Julius Caesar, his death, right? Beware the Ides of March. And then the secession of him by Augustus Caesar, who really is the guy who enshrines the empire. But generally, Julius Caesar is seen as an imperialist and as somebody who is not a man of the people. He was a man of, I think, by implication, a man of the established landed forces, the wealthy, because empire is generally associated with wealth. But what Michael Parenti does in this book is bring up the distinct possibility and make a strong case that actually Julius Caesar was killed, perhaps because he was a man of the people, not because he was transitioning Rome from a republic to an empire, because many of the forces who wanted that to happen were glad to see that happen. And it was actually that he was a countervailing force to the landed nobility, the landed gentry, essentially, of ancient Rome, and that he was killed because he was a man of the people, and in a sense, they were used to call them tribunes of the people. He was a tribune of the people who may not have given the landed vested interests what they wanted, which ultimately was imperial Rome.
Well, that's the first time I've ever heard that story, and it's remarkable, and it has the ring of truth to it. Now, let's get to the election.
Speaking of empires and transitions and knives in the back, how about that? Speaking of knives in the back,
yeah.
Well, you know, A2 Hillary.
It's a friend of yours on Facebook, a friend of mine on Facebook, Irina Clark, sent me a note the other night that I thought was absolutely and totally profound. She said this may be the very last time someone like a Donald Trump, somebody who is really not part of the establishment, not part of the real 1%, but rather, even though a billionaire, an outsider to them, she said this is probably the last time in American history we will see someone rise that far as a potential candidate.
Now I'm going to be really hopeful here. I know it's going to be sickly sweet, but I think that actually may not be true. I actually think that Donald Trump may be a catalyst that will make it more likely that we will see outliers get into the system, because ultimately, like, as things go now, we're seeing the counterattack. Now, after the bombshell was dropped last week, and by the way, Comey, who I think was basically, this was a rear guard action to cover his posterior and try and save his reputation. Because ultimately, these emails, what we're getting from the perpetually leaking FBI, is that these emails were not sent by Hillary Clinton directly to Huma Abedin, but these look to be correspondences between Huma Abedin and other low-level minions inside the State Department. So if that's the case, the exposure of Hillary Clinton is minimal, next to none, if that does turn out to be the case. Ultimately, what I think may happen, because they're processing the emails, is if they come back and say, well, we didn't find anything, that almost puts a second stamp of approval on Comey's decision to not indict, which is one of the things the mess he's been trying to clean up this whole time. But ultimately, let's just say that she goes ahead and wins in 8 days.
All right.
What I see happening is that Trump and Trump's people will continue to pull apart the Republican Party and rend it. I think if Hillary becomes president, then what we will see is that the progressives and the Sandinistas and even some Occupy people and millennials who just not just had to hold their nose, but they literally had to get a clothespin or three of them and put them on their nose and to put a hat on with those car fresheners, you know, attached to it, to walk in and cast their vote. When they come out and they see what's left, because, okay, we stopped Donald Trump, we got rid of the guy, he's not going to destroy everything, they are then going to turn their sights onto her. Because ultimately, John, what's going to happen? It's going to be constant investigations. The Clinton Foundation's not going away. By the way, the FBI is gathering evidence on the Clinton Foundation right now.
Yeah, but you know very well, once they become president, all that stops. Look at Lyndon Johnson was going to be dumped by John Kennedy as the vice president because of the scandals of Bobby Baker. time right. in life were doing cover stories on the criminality of Bobby Baker being the bag man for Lyndon Johnson. Those articles were never published once Kennedy was killed and Johnson got in the White House. So you're saying that once she becomes president, they're going to ramp up the investigation?
No, what no, I'm saying is, you know, what I'm saying down. Is going to happen is once she gets in there, the people who held their nose and were convinced to not have President Vagina Grabber will then say, well, now that we did that, you're either going to do something about student loans, you're either going to do something about Wall Street, or we're sick of you and we don't want you either. I actually think that her election will catalyze a process inside the Democratic Party that we've been seeing going on inside the Republican Party, where it is going to bust into two, because I just cannot imagine that people inside the Democratic Party who are the activists, particularly the millennials, because the one thing that was not present when LBJ was literally able to get away from murder, and I do believe Joan Mellon on that, who's, you know, she has all her ducks in a row, is the internet did not exist. And wow. The millennials were not around, who are cynical about everything. There was not... The environment now is such, this guy, Senator Burr from North Carolina, made a little crack at a little fundraiser inside North Carolina, a bunch of like-minded NRA members, about how it was too bad that this gun magazine that had Hillary Clinton's face on it didn't also have a target on her face. Okay.
Ooh, wow.
So he made this little crack to like 30 people. They all laughed. Guess what? 5 days later, it's all over the news. There literally is no escape anymore. And I think what it's done is it's created two things. One, sometimes we have no idea what's real and what's not real. There's so much disinformation in the system that it makes it hard to pick stuff out of, you know, pick the pepper out of the feces, right?
But, well, you know, Joe, the biggest surprise and shock to me, more so than a kitty cat video playing the piano that gets 12,000 or 12 million views, you probably saw it. It was this short clip of Congressman Trey Gowdy. I believe he's from Carolina.
Yep.
He is admonishing the public for being stupid by believing the media that does not report anything. And it got 13 million hits.
Yep.
I mean, attacking the media in America, a congressman nobody knows, and he gets 13 million hits. That, to me, is astonishing.
Well, I'll give you another thing too, and why I think that there's so much wiggle room in the system. I believe that one of the reasons why you're seeing a push for Cold War 2.0 is that back when LBJ did not get dumped off the ticket, the one thing that kept the system in check, that kept the system in place, was the Cold War. Basically, foreign policy or political disagreements end at the water's edge. Foreign policy is sacrosanct. And ultimately, we as Republicans and Democrats will come together because there are atheist pinko commies trying to destroy us. So if you have this, if you can come together collectively against a common enemy, you can create political cohesion in a system that would otherwise fall apart. I think that's one of the reasons.
Joe, excuse me, foreign policy has grown more powerful and more entrenched. I mean, now we are fighting people who don't exist.
Well, John, at the same time, China is now actually exerting hegemony over the South China Sea, and there's not a whole hell of a lot we can do other than
It's their area.
Exactly. It's the South China Sea. It's not South Georgia Sea or the South Florida Sea. It's South China Sea.
Exactly.
So this is, I actually see, I think that American foreign policy is waning in power and influence. I think that the increased number of deployments is not a sign that American strength is growing. I think it's a sign that American strength is weakening, ironically, because one of the things that is no longer in place, this unipolar world that the United States had in the 90s, when Clinton and company sent the Harvard boys over to Russia to give it shock therapy and destroyed that economy and let a drunken buffoon be president by endorsing him consistently in Boris Yeltsin.
Yeah.
And because there was this power vacuum. The United States could basically run amok. This is why the neocons wrote this project for a new American century, because they actually knew that if the United States did not make a massive power play to create basically a lockdown on the world, that there was not going to be another American century.
Well, then let's sort of pole vault forward to the time when, as you predict, American foreign policy is now into the graveyard. If it goes into the graveyard, what would have to happen, I believe, is that a lot of scholars would say, well, how did this all start? And then they would rewind to November 22nd, 1963.
Yes.
They would have to find out that U.S. foreign policy was responsible for the murder of John Kennedy and responsible for Iraq and Vietnam and all the lies to which they admit now. Do you think at the end, when they're in the graveyard, that these scholars would have the courage to say, our government was a government, as Lance DeHaven Smith calls them, of serial murderers murdering their own, from John Kennedy to Martin Luther King to Malcolm X and maybe to John Lennon? Do you think that these scholars would have the courage to stand up in an America where the foreign policy no longer exists and said, you know what, this is what our country has done to get where we are today?
Well, look at the British. The British actually no longer blink at looking at the dark underbelly of a British empire, because what? British empire has come to an end. And when you're no longer, it's no longer necessary to sustain the lie, because the whole system is predicated on the lie. If the system begins to fade and is no longer a viable system, you can then examine the lie. Maybe there'll be a future Michael Parenti who will write about John F. Kennedy the way that he wrote about Julius Caesar, because a possible allegory there, right? Or a connection there. But I mean, John, I think the X factor in all of this is that the number one challenge that American foreign policy is going to face is that it cannot be the guarantor of an international system when climate change begins to move millions of people out of low-lying delta areas in South and Southeast Asia. It is not going to be able to deal with the huge displacements that are coming. It is not going to be able to manage a system that, by the way, economically is in complete and total stasis. The global economic system is not a functioning system the way it was. There's a really interesting piece today in the Times about how we've had economic growth, but no functional increase in international trade. So economies are growing, but trading is not growing. That's the first time that's ever happened.
Well, that's an interesting analogy. You mentioned a future Michael Parenti. Would there be a future Karl Marx, who might look at the world in such a way as to say, you know, this system just is not working? Now, listen, Karl Marx, the guy thinks, you know, Americans think the guy was evil, that he was Satan. He was not. Sure. What they were doing, they were analyzing a corrupt capitalistic system of child labor in England, and they were trying to think of a better way for humans to live, okay? Now, do you think that that's possible, that someone will come along, an economist or sociologist or Michael Parenti, who say, hey, you know what, we have to design a whole new system? Do you think
that's
possible?
The system is being designed whether we like it or not.
You may be right. We don't know.
I mean, we have 3D printing, driverless cars. Think about it. I believe there's like upwards of 10 million Americans right now who depend upon driving, some form of driving, as their main income.
You want to know something? You are absolutely right. In 1970, Buckminster Fuller said, what Americans are going to have to learn to do someday is to live without working, because work will not be essential. Yes. They'll have a free home to live in. They'll have free food. They'll have free recreation. They're going to have to find something meaningful to do that is not work. And it looks like if you have driverless cars and you have 3D printing, then you're going to have 90% of all humans incapable of having a job.
Well, and then think about it. We've turned our meaning as human beings, though our lives are centered around work giving us our primary source of meaning and motivation in life. So that is a fundamental thing. But just to get there, this is one of the reasons why, you know, down the road from me in Silicon Valley, one of the hottest topics is something called UBI, Universal Basic Income. And there are a lot of big heavy hitters in Silicon Valley, hedge funders who manage billions of dollars, who are very interested in the idea that we all get a basic income guaranteed every year, because they can see with what they are investing in that what is coming is going to be a scarcity of employment. We are heading into a period of joblessness that is unprecedented. And as you point out, you know, it has been predicted for a long time, but it is right around the corner.
As they're doing it in Silicon Valley, the new Prime Minister of Canada is doing it in Canada, working on a system in Canada where they will all have equal income. It'll be small, but it'll be there. It'll be more than Social Security that we have here. Well, I must tell you, I just love being together with two Italian Americans tonight. You guys were just wonderful. Okay, Joe, tell us where we can hear you next. Tell us where. And would you do me a favor? I will be happy to pay for it. Would you send Michael Parenti a subscription to your News Vandal? He would love it. You will be my guest. I'd love to pay for it. Tell folks where they can get that and where they can hear you.
Well, just go to newsvandal.com, NEWSVANDAL. If you go to newsvandal.com, a box will pop up. You can sign up. It's great if you can give me $10 a month, but I do give it out free. The $10 a month is voluntary. I've done it for almost 6 years, and I've never missed a day, Monday through Friday. It comes to your inbox. And you can listen to me tomorrow night on the Ocelli Effect on American Freedom Radio. And then on Fridays on KRUU-FM, you can listen online, KRUU-FM, to Inside the Headlines at 2 p.m. Pacific. And John, as always, it's great to be with you. The one thing that's missing from this little Italian get-together is that Michael and I are not cooking gravy for you. You got to cook for you, you know what I mean? After we talk to you, we got to feed you. That's how we roll.
Now listen. Your wisdom feeds me plenty. I get fat on that unbelievably. I just love you guys. Anyway, I want to thank you all. I want to thank Mike Kim, my producer, without whom I could not do this show. And Doug and Don, I would like to thank them. They just have a wonderful operation with BBS Radio. And to all of you, thank you so much for your nice notes. And as Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck.
You're my spark. Nature's fire, you're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.